call to order the House Committee on Land Use. Good afternoon. Hope the weekend was good for everybody. We will start off this afternoon with our informational meeting concerning Measure 37 legal issues. And I'd like to have Richard Whitman and Stephanie Striffler come forward, please. And good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Little sheet of paper here.
I really don't know where you'd like to begin or which one would like to begin, but Stephanie, you just stepped right up to that microphone, so we'll let you take the lead.
I'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Let me introduce myself first, if that's all right. I'm Stephanie Striffler. I'm special counsel to the Attorney General, and I offered to come this afternoon because I understand the committee has questions about the Department of Justice's work on Measure 37 and our role with respect to the measure. My personal role in that is I report to the Attorney General, and one of the projects he has asked me to take on at the moment is to coordinate the department's work on Measure 37. Again, with the committee's chair and committee's permission, I'd be happy to provide some information and background about what we're doing, what we have done, and so on.
Please do.
I also understand that the committee has some questions, maybe looking for some guidance on where legislative attention on Measure 37 might be productive, and we'd be happy to share a few thoughts about that. Richard Whitman, whom you've already had here at this committee, is here and can talk to some of those specifics. First, I want to make sure to say that what our office does is advise state government in response to requests from state government and the governor's office. And the way our budget works, it means that somebody has to pay us for our advice or opinions. Also, what it means is that what we say, even in an Attorney General opinion, is binding only on state government and not on anybody else in the state. Some may recall the Measure 7 Attorney General opinion, which Richard and I also both worked on. And I wanted to say a little bit about how that situation is different from Measure 37. The Measure 7 Attorney General opinion was issued at the request of the governor. It cost almost $300,000 of our hourly rate to produce, and it was issued at a time when Measure 7 had been enjoined by a court and so was not being implemented. And even in that context, as I say, it cost $300,000, was 110 pages long. Here we have a little bit of a different challenge. We're working with the governor's office and the rest of state government as Measure 37 is in the process of being implemented. So what we've done is we worked first with the governor's office to set some priorities about what legal work needed to be done first. The first job for state government is to get Measure 37 implemented and underway. And the first questions that we worked on were questions that were necessary in order to set up the claims process. And we're providing ongoing advice about that. I know you heard about the DAS rules and claims process last week. We also are providing ongoing advice to some of the agencies, in particular DLCD, as they review these claims. And our work is constantly being informed by what those claims have in them. New questions are constantly raised as we look at the claims. Now we're working with state agencies and the governor's office on some of the questions that we need to figure out in order to respond to those claims. As you know, there's a clock ticking, and unless action is taken within 180 days from the claim, we'll be in court. So we know that we're on a short timeline and are trying to address the most important questions first. And irregularly reviewing the claims with DLCD, and as I said, those claims themselves give rise to questions. We're also working on a team with local government who's having their own issues to deal with in terms of responding to claims. That's what our process is at the moment. Some of our advice, some conclusions reflecting our advice have been made public. Some of them are reflected in the DAS rules. Some have been made public through statements from the governor's office or others. And we anticipate that more of that advice will probably be made public as we move forward. I'm happy to answer further questions about our general process, or Hersha would be able to talk about some of the issues that we've seen as we've worked on Measure 37 where the measure could benefit from some legislative work.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Richard Whitman from the Oregon Department of Justice. I'd like to talk today about, as Stephanie said, a few areas that we've identified based on working on specific claims where where some clarification, either by court or by the legislature, is desirable in order for government, both state government and local government, to know what they need to do to implement Measure 37. I think the issue that rises to the top of the list fairly quickly, first and foremost, is the issue of it comes back to the relief that is allowed under the measure. As you know, a property owner has a right to either receive compensation for a reduction in value, or the government entity may decide to, in one way or another, waive or not apply a particular law. And the issue that we see coming to the forefront for local government in particular, but also for state government, is with regard to state statutes. And when Director Shetterly and I were here 2 weeks ago, we talked about this briefly, but I want to try to clarify what the issue is for the committee. A large number of the land use regulations, if you will, that really control what happens in the rural areas of our state are state statutes. And in particular, the state statutes in ORS Chapter 215 that govern farm uses and other uses on rural lands. It's not clear under Measure 37 who has the authority to make a decision to not apply or to waive those state statutes. And if anybody other than the legislature, either a local government or a state agency, does not have the authority to waive those state statutes, then the necessary implication is that they are going to be on the hook for paying compensation if a claim derives from those state statutes. If they can waive those state statutes, then I think there's more of a policy question for the legislature as to whether it's comfortable with what existing law provides in terms of guidance to local government and to the state for under what circumstances they should not be applying those state statutes. But because of the fact that the measure is very ambiguous on this particular point, and the risk is that we won't be able to waive those particular laws and thus have to pay property owners for those claims. This is why this particular issue rises to the top quite quickly. So I want to pause there and see if there are any questions from the committee before I go on to talk about some other things. Okay.
Let me just ask you one if I can.
Yes.
Doesn't a state ballot measure supersede an existing statute?
Mr. Chair, in this case, the ballot measure is not a constitutional amendment. It is a statutory initiative adopted by the voters. It does not necessarily supersede existing statutes. What we try to do, to the extent possible, is to construe all statutes so that they can all work harmoniously together. So that's sort of the approach on construing an initiative of this sort.
So one statute doesn't have a priority over another statute, in essence. So if you have statutes in conflict, that's when your department comes. Would you say there are statutes in conflict because of ballot measure 37?
Mr. Chair, the short answer to that is I think there are some, at least some tensions between Measure 37, the provisions of Measure 37, and other provisions of state statute. And that is one of the things that when we are providing legal advice to the state on, we have to try to resolve using the rules for doing that that the courts have given us to resolve those sorts of conflicts. And there are various rules such as the more specific law generally controls over the more general is one of the more common ones. This particular law is part of the measure that was adopted by the Oregon voters, provides that it's to be codified as part of ORS Chapter 197, which is the portion of your laws that is really the primary land use laws of the state of Oregon. So we are, in construing Measure 37 and interpreting it, trying to interpret it in a way so that it fits in with the rest of Chapter 197, because that's where the voters told us to put it.
Proceed.
Okay. Another question that we're seeing, and this one is really coming up in specific claims that we're starting to evaluate now, has to do with ownership of property and who is entitled to relief. As a general matter, Measure 37 provides that if a government is not going to pay, but instead is going to waive laws, that the present owner of the property has a right to carry out a use of the property that was allowed when the present owner acquired the property. We're seeing a fair number of situations where an owner, usually an individual, has transferred ownership of their property to, for instance, a living trust, or to a closely held corporation, or they've transferred part of the ownership of the property to family members. And so the question presented is, does that mean that they're entitled to go back to the laws when that individual first acquired the property, or at the time when ownership was transferred to the living trust, the closely held corporation, or some of the other family members, including that individual? That is another point that is not completely clear under this measure and that would benefit from some clarification from legislature, or I'm afraid we may get some clarification from the courts, if not from the legislature, on that.
Mr. Whitman, let me, this is kind of a direct question.
Yeah.
Would you rather issue your opinion and have the courts debate that, or would you rather just let the courts debate the issue, period?
Mr. Chair, I think regardless of what the Oregon Department of Justice says or doesn't say, even if we do issue an opinion, a formal opinion on Measure 37, there is still going to be litigation over the measure, and courts are still going to either agree or disagree with what we say. Necessarily, even if we do not issue a formal Attorney General opinion on particular points, we are advising the state agencies, including the Department of Land Conservation and Development, as well as the Governor's Office, on how to respond to specific claims. So even if the legal position of the state is not articulated in a comprehensive opinion as we issued for Measure 7, you are going to see the state's legal position articulated in the DAS rules that have been issued, in decisions on particular claims, in perhaps letters of advice on specific issues having to do with the measure. So there are a variety of ways that the legal advice of the department can be communicated to the public and looked at by the courts.
Thank you. Representative Greenberg has a question.
Yes.
among
the ambiguities that you've been looking at, and you talk about it fitting into 197, is there any ambiguity about what kind of government actions are covered in Measure 37?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I think the answer to that has to be yes. I think you've already, this committee has already heard some question, for instance, about whether land division ordinances are covered by the measure. I would say there are lots of additional questions concerning what laws are covered by the measure as a result of the definition that's provided in the measure itself, which, you know, parts of that definition are very clear. Other parts of that definition are not.
Thank you, sir. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Measure 37, as I read it, requires the filing of a cause of action in circuit court. Of course, we can amend that if we wish to. Would there be any alternatives available to us to provide for a direct appeal to the Court of Appeals and circumvent the circuit court process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, certainly I think within the legislature's authority to do that, the one thing that you may want to think about in considering that possibility is the Court of Appeals is normally reviewing a record that has been created by a circuit court or by a state agency or somebody. I think one concern in having things go directly to the Court of Appeals is somebody, if they're going to be carrying out their normal role, somebody has to first create a record.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Whitman, I'm a little confused in looking at the initiative. It seems to me that there's concern that, and we've heard a lot of testimony as to how should the state apply and how should the counties apply. How do you interpret the phrase in subsection 8, the governing body responsible for enacting the land use regulation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, this is the exact language that I was talking about with regard to the first issue that I raised. That language on its face appears to authorize the governing body, as it says, to not apply or to remove or to modify the law that was the basis for the claim. Governing body is a term that is used elsewhere in ORS Chapter 197. It usually means the body that was responsible for the adoption or enactment of the law. So at the county level, that would normally be the County Board of Supervisors. City level, it would normally be City Council. State agency, it would be whatever the decision-making body is for the state agency. For a statute, it probably would be the legislature, although that particular context is not used elsewhere in Chapter 197.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So unless the legislature wants to do waivers or pay compensation, it might be wise for us to delegate it to the county or city or at some lower level who do the periodic plans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's correct. That's exactly my point. That if the state doesn't want to pay compensation, then it would be highly desirable to have legislative clarification of whether that delegated authority exists or not.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to add a point on the review question that Representative Ackerman raised. We noted in our opinion on Measure 7 that Chapter 293, which provides for process for claims against the state, has a review process in it. And so that review process likely applies to claims that are filed with the Department of Administrative Services. The problem is that there's also this separate circuit court process authorized under Measure 37, and that may also be a good place for some clarification.
May I follow up along those same lines? I'm trying to, not being an attorney, sometimes you have to really focus to stay with you. You just said there was a process in play presently from Measure 7
that
you would likely adopt.
No, what I meant to say was that in the Measure 7 opinion, we noted that there is already a statutory process that applies to all claims made against the state. And we said that that process would apply to claims under Measure 7 under the same reasoning that process would apply to claims under Measure 37.
And who created that?
The legislature.
If I could, Mr. Chair, it is a general process pre-existing that's set up for dealing with financial claims against the state.
All kinds of claims.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So it's a very broad list that you would adapt to this specific situation.
And that's what the Department of Administrative Services has done with its claims rules, is use the statutory authority, the pre-existing statutory authority under Chapter 293.
Representative Ackerman.
But then what happens if you have a decision of a county and also a decision of a state, and then you find yourself appealing to two different bodies on the same factual setting?
That could happen.
I know it can happen, but the question is, should it happen? And you know, obviously this should be an area of amending the statutes or amending 37 so we have a consistent appeal process for every claim.
That could be helpful, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, that is one of the other sort of general issues. Just generally, it appears that both local government and the state could be making independent decisions under this measure. And that creates the issue of what happens if those decisions go in different directions. You know, how does the property owner deal with that? And that just is not really addressed by the measure.
Can I just follow a question on the previous questions I had? If the state were to delegate to lower levels of government, how do you deal then with Department of Forestry or DSO that have permits that would be involved in Measure 37?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think in order to be sure that you are not putting the state in a position where it has to pay a claim, doesn't have any choice because it doesn't have the authority to waive, you would need to give the waiver authority, to delegate the waiver authority, both the state agencies where it's a state, where it's a decision that doesn't involve local government at all, and probably to local government where it's the local government's decision that's really an issue. So you'd have to be covering, I think, both bases.
Okay.
Many of our cities and counties have been left, as far as procedures are concerned, have pretty well been left hanging in the wind. They look to a state agency, the LCD, for instructions, for guidelines, for help. The LCD says we can't do anything legally unless we have an opinion from the Department of Justice. So we have somewhat of a roadblock, a bottleneck. Does the agency in question, Mr. Whitman, might, and again, I understand you can't speak for the entire agency or Mr. Myers, is there any urgency in the department at the moment to issue some opinions in regards to 37.
Mr. Chair, it certainly is urgent, and there are, I don't know, I should have counted before I came over here. We have numerous attorneys working on various aspects of Measure 37 and how it can be implemented. One of those aspects is how DLCD is to deal with local governments. As I mentioned, however, we cannot, and I think your question reflects, we can't directly advise local governments, but we can work with DLCD about how they can work with local governments, and we are doing that.
So it's kind of, you're kind of sliding on it, because indirectly, through DLCD, you do control local governments, because you can direct DLCD in a certain direction.
Mr. Chair, if I could, pretty much right from the outset, I think the state this time around, this is another difference between Measure 37 and 7, has been working very hard to coordinate with local government. We frankly didn't do a lot of that with regard to Measure 7, and I think we've learned from that experience, and we've actually been working very hard to act differently this time. There's a fine line between providing guidance to local government, which we are working very hard to do in our weekly meetings with local government, and directing local government. And we're very cognizant of that, and we are trying to work with local government in a way that truly provides them guidance but doesn't dictate to them exactly how they have to act. Part of that is trying to give local government heads up when we see an issue coming so that they can work with us to try to avoid the issue. And that has happened in a number of instances already with regard to this measure. It also means we are going to come out with something public on the measure, giving a heads up to local government about that so they're not surprised by it, and we're doing that as well. So we take that role, I think, very seriously, and I think we're working hard to hit the right balance in terms of our interaction with local government.
It's good to hear you say that. I don't think it's as important as to who makes these guidelines up as it is that we get it as right as we normally can within a time period that will be useful. And that time is now, not 6 months from now or a year from now. Even if we're wrong on some things, I believe, and a little later on today, our committee will be able to discuss this in an open work session, how each of us feel in this regards. But it's important that we do something for our counties and our cities and our local governments as rapidly as possible, and that we do it as knowingly correct as we can. And that's why we look to you. And understand that's why the spotlight, for at least at this moment, has swung to you, in that you're the most knowledgeable people, in essence, you and DLCD. And so the people have nowhere else to look. So that's why we invited you here today, and that's where the committee's interest is in. So we appreciate your candid answers in that regard. Is there, given that preface that I just made, is there a timeline in your mind where you feel you will begin to issue some opinions that will aid this state of Oregon right now?
Let me say, first of all, what becomes issued publicly is not our choice. That's something that is a decision of the people who ask us for advice. But as Mr. Whitman said, we do anticipate very shortly some of that advice being made public on some of these issues that we know are of most concern to local government very shortly.
And you understand, as an example on the transferability issue.
Yes.
You have been quoted publicly as saying Department of Justice does not believe that the transferability issue is there. I mean that the property is not transferable. Now, if that's something the legislature needs to take care of, if that is your legal opinion, is it or isn't it?
Yes, that is our legal opinion, and the public statements that have been made by the governor's office about that reflect our legal advice, and that analysis is one that we expect to be made public very shortly.
And I ask that not to pin right or wrong or agree or not to agree, but only that we need that to begin this process. Any other questions from committee members? Anything either of you would like to add at this point?
I can certainly add that we appreciate the challenge that the measure presents to both state and local government, and we're happy to help not only as our state executive branch clients ask us, but if there is assistance that the legislative branch would like, we would be happy to help.
Do you feel that liability is a big issue as far as Measure 37 is concerned?
Can you say more?
Mr. Chair, I think until we resolve this issue with authority to waive state statutes in particular, that yes, liability of government for Measure 37 claims is a big issue.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for using with me.
Thank you.
We will close the informational meeting and open a public hearing on House Bill 2438. Sam?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The bill seeks to modify the rulemaking authority of the Land Conservation Development Commission as it relates to the exception process of statewide planning goals. Very briefly, the state has a process for counties and cities to go through for regard to land use applications that may not necessarily apply with to certain provisions, certain goals that the state may have, and that would be called the exception process. And this particular measure that you have before you is one that you, those of you who were on the committee in 2003, had acted upon this issue. It was passed by the House floor, and then the issue died at the end of the session in 2003. And it's an outgrowth of a series of court cases in Yamhill County. Very briefly, someone sought to be able to develop a piece of property in the county with a home on the property, and went through the exception process. The county had approved it, and with that decision was appealed. That decision, a legal native decision, that it was a viable option to go through the exception process. The Luba's decision ended up being appealed into the Court of Appeals, which reversed Luba's decision and said that no, that was not appropriate use. And the essence of the question came down to that because the use for a non-farm dwelling was listed as a permitted use, that the exception process was not a viable option. So the measure that you have before you would seek to modify the would require the state land use commission to essentially come up with a exception process and rules that could be used to approve exception process where they might otherwise comply with the standards of the particular zone and goals in question.
Committee, this is in essence a non-Measure 37 issue, and this may be one of the few issues that
is not consensus,
I guess. So I'll ask Carlin Levy and Al Johnson to come forward. Committee, we have four folks signed up to testify, and we'll take them two at a time. And everyone that is testifying has marked that they're for this bill. So...
version.
Harlan, good afternoon, Mr. Johnson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, Senior Staff Attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors, here to testify in support of House Bill 2438. I wanted to thank the Chair for bringing this bill forward at our request. This bill deals with the exceptions process. As your administrator mentioned, the exceptions process was changed by a court decision a few years ago, and this bill seeks to change it back to the way that it was for almost 30 years. Let me just back up a little bit and explain what the exceptions process is. It is designed to be an escape valve for local governments to avoid some of the requirements of statewide planning goals in certain rare circumstances. Now, exceptions are not easy to obtain. They are, in fact, very difficult to obtain, similar to a variance would be in a regular zoning ordinance. In order to take an exception, a local government has got to show that either the land is already physically developed, the land is already irrevocably committed to uses not allowed by the goal, or that there are reasons which justify that the state policy embedded in the goal should not apply. And that third exception, a reasons exception, is probably the hardest of the three to obtain. What happened with this court decision in 2002, the Court of Appeals ruled, and the name of the case is DLCD versus Yamhill County. The Court of Appeals ruled that a county could not, as a matter of law, take an exception to allow for a use anytime that use was allowed by the applicable goal. This was a new interpretation of the law. The court used the administrative rule that LCDC had pertaining to exceptions to derive this decision, and frankly, we believe that it was a bad decision. The problem is this particular landowner did not appeal this decision to the Oregon Supreme Court. If he had done so, this decision may not have stood. However, he did not appeal it, so we are left with the Court of Appeals decision being the law of Oregon. This bill, as I mentioned, would reverse that decision and bring us back to a situation where a county or a city could take an exception to a statewide planning goal to allow a use even if that use is permitted by the underlying goal. Remember, this does not make an exception any easier. It does not relax the very difficult criteria to obtain an exception. It only says that as a matter of law, the local government is permitted to take this route that it had been permitted to take for nearly 30 years. With that, I would respectfully request that you move this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I did want to mention that this bill, a very similar bill, a nearly identical bill, passed in the 2003 session. That was House Bill 2860A. It did pass the House of Representatives unanimously, but did not make it through the Senate. Got caught up in some politics towards the end. With that, I will conclude my testimony and be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Any questions for Mr. Levy? Seeing none, Mr. Johnson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Al Johnson. I am the attorney for a lot of folks, but I'm here today as attorney for Bandon Dunes Destination Resort. And I am here because this is an issue which almost derailed a very, very important project on the Oregon coast and could affect its ability to respond to changing conditions in the future. And so I wanted to be able to explain to you how that is and to kind of provide a certain amount of institutional memory in terms of the documentation exchanges we had with LCDC, DLCD, and the course of going through that process. And also, just to go all the way back, I've been practicing land use law in Oregon since almost a year or two after Senate Bill 100 was adopted, when I was retained by LCDC to serve as one of its hearings officials on the appeals. We were the predecessor to the Land Use Board of Appeals. And during that time, a lot of sort of early case law on what the goals mean and how they work was adopted, and a lot of that eventually became rules. Those cases, from the very beginning, included some exceptions which are inconsistent with the court decision that you're really being asked to correct in this particular situation. And I'll talk about those a little bit more. Basically, as Harlan said, what we're asking you to do is to simply reinstate the exceptions process as it was originally conceived. It's a process whereby local governments can take exceptions to land use goals, and the idea is that it is a process for taking exceptions to requirements of the goals. And from the very beginning, the idea has been that those departures are to be departures that are as narrow as is necessary to accomplish the reasons for the exceptions. You just don't take a blanket exception. You try to stay as close as you can to requirements of the goals. It's also in many of the cases, the acknowledgement orders, and the rules themselves on exceptions, that exceptions are possible to a number of goals which don't actually prescribe uses or prescribe uses at all. Those can include Goal 6, which is an air quality and water quality goal. They can include Goal 14. In fact, the proposed new amendments to Goal 14, which LCDC is looking at right now, include potential for taking exceptions to requirements of that goal. Those requirements may or may not involve uses. So the issue is important because there is a very, very long list of uses which are allowed subject to a variety of restrictions under any of the goals. Goal 3, Goal 4, the agricultural and forest goals, as well as Goal 10, which is the housing goal. And the court's new rule, which basically says it is not legally possible to take an exception for any use which is on any terms allowed under a goal, in essence reduces the range of uses for which you can take an exception down to an extremely narrow universe of uses. And there are, in fact, a couple of recent LUBA cases in which LUBA is already trying to split hairs because it is having such a hard time reconciling this decision with what LCDC and local governments have been doing over the years. Now, the Bandon Dunes Destination Resort, what I've done is I've given you some materials that include correspondence from DLCD. We began the process of basically vetting this property in 1993. It took us 3 years to make the complete tour of all the state agencies and interest groups and whatnot and get all the questions answered that need to be answered before we filed our application. Some of this, the correspondence that's attached here includes correspondence from DLCD, which is consistent with its past guidance on destination resorts. And that guidance is there are two ways to get a destination resort. One way is by following the statutory or Goal 8 process, which lays out a set of very specific restrictions and definitions and qualifications for a destination resort. And that is why the destination resort is listed, just like a non-farm home or a farm use home or a landfill, why it's listed in the EFU statute. That's what gives it a problem under this case. But the guidance in those handbooks and in that correspondence is that you can take an exception to do a destination resort. That is exactly contrary to the ruling in the Yamhill case. Based on that guidance, we took an exception for this destination resort, and the reason we did that was that without taking an exception, Coos County would never have a destination resort, because every place that is within 2 or 3 miles of the coast, which is the only place you would have a destination resort in Coos County, which is it's fairly narrow north to south, is within 3 miles of a group of cranberry bogs. Cranberry bogs are high-value croplands. Destination resort statutes and rules say you can't have a destination resort site within 3 miles of high-value croplands. Those are just the kinds of siting restrictions that create the kinds of limitations that are typical of uses that are allowed subject to restrictions
as under the EFU statutes and other statutes. That's what makes us like those other ones. So because we couldn't do that, we had to take an exception. And we took the exception. We addressed every issue. There was a lot of opposition the first time around. In the end, there was an appeal. 1,000 friends and a local group took an appeal to the Land Use Board of Appeals. But after reviewing the record, on the 21st day, they decided not to file a petition for review. And so the destination resort went in. It was built. And we went back 3 years later. And by that time, the resort had been started up. It had become world famous. We wanted to expand it. We had good reasons to do so. We had one person testify in sort of opposition. There were no appeals. But again, it was done as an exception. We're now up to 3 golf courses. There's material on the background of the course and its impact on the local economy and its standing in the world in materials you have there. It's quite likely that in the future, for various reasons, it'll be necessary to modify our existing exceptions because they are planned provisions when you do exceptions. And every time you modify an exception, you have to take another exception. It may not be a very difficult one, but still an exception. Under the Yamhill County case, we can't get that exception. So I'm simply asking you, I don't want to go into all the detail, but if you look through these materials, you'll see that history. The only additional bit of sort of deeper prehistory, or going back to the very beginning kind of history I would give you, is that I did have a case also in Coos County, back in the late 70s when I was a hearings official, that was brought to us. It was called Eichworth versus Coos County, which would also have had to have been decided differently in this case. That was a case involving a very, very elaborately documented exception that Coos County took in order to allow a modest expansion of the marina at the Charleston Boat Marina. That would technically have violated a requirement on the Goal 16, which is the coastal estuary goal. That goal allows the building of a marina, but it does not allow the dredging that would take place, and it was about 100 square feet or a couple hundred square feet that needed to be dredged. And so they had to take an exception to that requirement of the goal. And that exception, that very, very limited exception, was found to be justified. They were allowed to dredge in order to do that based upon meeting all the other requirements. In that case, as in this case, as in the case of Mr. Walker, that actually is the Yamhill County case, there are requirements that you exclude alternative locations, that you show you couldn't do it someplace else better. It's quite obvious that Mr. Walker, Land Use Board of Appeals turned him down. He still would have had to show that he couldn't do this in some other way. All those requirements, as Harlan said, are still in place. This simply puts the exception process back to the place where it is, where it allows the kind of flexibility that keeps the program healthy. So that's my pitch, and I appreciate your listening to me. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of Mr. Johnson? Are you still proposing to amend this bill, Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I have indicated a couple of potential amendments. I'm not wedded to those. So if consensus requires that those not be done, that would I'm fine with that. One of the amendments is simply one that recognizes a little more clearly that this is a continuation of existing law and clarification, and so therefore you don't have to have it apply only prospectively. We would like it to be clear forever that Bannon Dunes is legal, and this makes that more clear. I mean, we've passed all the appeal times and things like that, but we would just like it to be crystal clear in the law of the state of Oregon that that's a legal resort, and that takes care of that issue. That's the main one.
Mr. Levy, how are you with having the bill amended?
Mr. Chair, we do not object to the amendments insofar as the consensus of everybody that is on this bill remains so. If the amendments were to derail the bill, we would have a problem with them. So, the amendments do clarify the bill and probably would make it a little more bulletproof. However, we think the bill is good as it is written, and we worry that any amending the bill might jeopardize the consensus that we have reached with all the various parties on the bill.
Any comments?
Committee members, questions? Thank you both very much. I may have you
Thank
come
you.
Back up. This We need to circle this day on the calendar because we have Ron Eber from DLCD who does not have an objection to this bill. I'm just kidding, Ron. And Art Schleck from AOC, will they come forward, please?
Morning, Mr. Chair.
Morning.
Good afternoon. Jeez, sorry about that. We've had a board legislative. I'm on AOC time, so I apologize for that. Mr. Chair, I'm with the committee, Art Schleck, with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I just want to put on the record that the Association of Oregon Counties is in support of House Bill 2438. We believe that an exception to a goal and to a requirement should be allowed at this point if it's evident that a use could not be approved, and that you should not require somebody to go through a permit application process before filing an exception when it's completely evident that they could not comply with the existing requirements. So we ask for the committee's support for the bill.
Any questions of Mr. Schleck? Ron, it's yours.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Eber with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'll keep it simple and short. The department supports the bill. We concur with the comments you've already heard about it. We think it will correct for what we believe is an incorrect interpretation of the Commission's longstanding rule on exceptions, and would urge its passage. I can point out that the landowner that was originally involved in this situation has already received approval for a non-farm dwelling, which both the county and ourselves thought he should have been the approval path that he should have taken originally. So this just will correct that for that interpretation and put everything back where it was.
Any questions of Mr. Eber? Do either of you have a feeling one way or the other as far as amending this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've seen the language proposed by Mr. Johnson. We have no objection.
Mr. Chair, I have not seen the language proposed amendment, but if it's, as long as it doesn't put this bill in harm's way, we would have no objection.
Okay. Thank you both very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to give testimony in regards to House Bill 2438? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2438, and the chair will accept a motion. We need to open a work session on House Bill 2438. It's always nice to have other chairs sitting next to you. So the work session is open on House Bill 2438. The chair would look for a motion. Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I move that we move House Bill 2438 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Anderson has moved House Bill 2438 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Hackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Jaylen?
Aye.
Nolan?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Sumner?
Aye.
Sure. Chair votes aye. House Bill 2438 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and will close the work session on House Bill 2438. The motion has been made to reopen the public the work session on House Bill 2438. Representative Greenick, would you care to put that in the motion?
Yes, I move you put 2438 on the consent calendar.
House Bill 2438 to be moved to the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, we'll move House Bill 2438 to the consent calendar. Okay, and now we'll close the work session on House Bill 2438. And committee will open a work session for a discussion on Measure 37. This is something The committee has sat here now for almost 3 weeks and listening to various testimony, and the chair thought it might be interesting for us just to share our own personal opinions and how we feel about what we need to do, how to go forward, etc. If you have any such feelings, you don't want to say anything, you don't have to. So but I just thought we'd open it and see if there was any direction that anybody felt that we should go. Representative Greenwood, somehow I knew you'd
well, I'm going to start with a concern. I think we do need to make Measure 37 work for the counties and local areas and the citizens, but what's really got me concerned, and the feeling grows as I sit here, is that this effectively blocks the cities and the counties in future time from doing things that they need to do, because I think it's so easy to be paralyzed that any attempt to zone some properties that need to be zoning or to do any kind of planning that's rational planning that most people would agree needs to be done in a democratic way and in the democratic process is likely to be, at least at the moment, really stopped. And somewhere we need to find a way to produce, it seems to me, the ability to make 37 work the way it needs to work to provide for grievances that folks have, but to not move into a situation where we deal with the tyranny of the minority. And you've been county officials, or local officials, or planning officials, and I don't think we can throw all that kind of work into the ash can, and that really makes me nervous. And I don't know if anybody else is having this. You know, I always thought that Measure 37 is something we have to go back and straighten out people. They had claims, they had X, Y, Z claims. I was in the midst of a planning process for the Linton community in Northwest Portland, in a place that makes all sorts of sense. There's a hillside, it's really bad. Nobody really wants to do what could be done under the current zoning. The city, the neighbors, Forest Park, a bunch of people are all working on it, making some plans, and the city attorney comes in and says, well, this is not really the time to do any planning because it would include a few down zones and a few things that make sense because you can't build a house on them anyway. But the city attorney comes in and says, well, given Measure 37, we don't think you can move ahead with this kind of rational planning for our neighborhood that needs to be planned so local residents can do what they in fact want to do. And that's just an example that became very, very clear to me in the last week because I saw a memo on it from the Portland City Planning people, and some way we need to figure out how to make these things that most everybody wants to do move forward with in some clear environment so they know what the consequences of their behavior is. And that's what's, I have a growing sense that we simply stop things dead with no way to restart them.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I guess, first of all, I'd like to say after sitting here for 3 weeks, you have to double your blood pressure medicine to sit on this committee. And that being said, I understand exactly what Representative Greenwood's talking about, but I think we need to go back to what the voters have spoken loudly and clearly in this state twice now, and I think we have an opportunity. I consider it an opportunity to clarify the language of what, you know, we get lots of questions, but these are the same people who wrote all the rules. So, to me, it's we need to clarify the language, maybe, in a common sense way, but we also have to remember what the voters were trying to tell us. And you might say that stops future planning. Well, we're going to have Measure 37. We have Measure 7. That is the direction I think we have to go as a legislative body and as a policymakers to take those into considerations. But at the end of the day, the people have spoken and they have said, we want this changed. Now, whether you go forward with how you change it, maybe that's what we decide, but I just think we need to clarify the language. I went to a meeting on Hood River on Friday, a Senate land use meeting, and people have the same questions. You know, we always have lots of questions. I think they're looking to us for answers.
Mr. Chair, can I comment?
Representative?
I think, Representative, that's a very important issue. And if we say we have to honor the voters, they voted for Measure 37, they meant exactly what it says in Measure 37, and I would say, fine, let's get out of the business, and let's let it go forward. Let's honor their will by letting it go forward, and let the courts decide the future. I mean, it seems to me odd to say the voters wanted exactly what was in that measure, and now we have to do all those things so we can make that measure work. Well, if they wanted exactly what was in Measure 37, let the voters have what's in Measure 37, which we all know can't work because of many of the questions we were talking here. All right, do we know that they wanted transferability, even though they didn't put transferability in? Do we know they wanted waivers instead of money, even though they put money in? I mean, what we're doing now is taking some things that had very vague and confusing language and trying to make it work, because in fact, I don't think there's any single person, including its chief sponsor, who really wanted those words. They have an idea of what they wanted, but they didn't necessarily turn out in the words of Measure 37. And if we really believe we have to honor 37 exactly as it is, let's not take any action to clarify. Let's say that's what they wanted. Let's give it to them. I don't think anybody here wants to do that, because I don't think we really do believe what they wanted is exactly what's in the wording of that measure. Representative Smith.
To respond to that, I don't think I said exactly what they wanted. And we have that opportunity. I see it as an opportunity for us as a legislative body, as a policy body, to make those decisions.
Exactly.
But I understand those voters very clearly. I hear from them every day. I know the intent. We talk a lot about the intent of that voter. I know what the intent of that voter is.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree with the comments that the point that Representative Smith makes about this presenting us with an opportunity. But I would suggest that the opportunity is for us to do the representative part of our title. And I would also suggest that the reason that there are 60 representatives in the body is that there are very broad perspectives from different corners of the state. If there weren't, there wouldn't be a reason for there to be 60 of us. One of us would do just fine if all the people who live in Oregon had the same opinion. I would actually submit that not all of the voters who voted yes on Measure 37 had exactly the same objective in mind. Some of them were interested in compensation for relatively minor issues imposed through land use and other regulations. Some of them were not at all interested in compensation and instead wanted waiver of regulations. I would be willing to bet a fair amount of money that the people who live in Representative Sumner's district, for example, just to pick one, who voted yes on 37, as a group, want different things out of it than the folks in your district, Mr. Chair, who voted yes, or the people in my district who voted yes. And it's the opportunity that we have to find the common ground there that I think this committee and this body needs to rise to. I actually suggest that one of the ways we do that is both individually going home and listening to the people in our districts, and perhaps collectively doing the same thing. And I know that the chair is planning on scheduling hearings outside this building. And I think it's really important for us to listen to people in different communities around the state in order to try to find some common ground and raise the issues that we've heard, acknowledge that there is some tension, some ambiguity, some opportunities, but acknowledge that it isn't crystal clear and that we are looking for ways to respect and honor the desires, the will of the voters, while at the same time respecting and honoring existing guidelines, both at a state level, but personally I think more importantly, the guidelines that elected officials in local communities all around the state have implemented on behalf of the people who live in those communities and trying to find a way to salvage as much of both of them as we can. I've learned a lot in the last 2.5-3 weeks about how much of a challenge it will be to honor all of those imperatives, but I think we're up to it.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like, I guess the rest of you, I've been back home a couple weekends and have heard a lot, not only email here, but also down there from people, town hall meeting on Saturday, number of meetings over the weekend. And it's my impression that the people, when they voted on this, voted in a very simple fashion. They had voted for Measure 7. That got thrown out because it was essentially more than one issue. And then they voted again here. And I don't find them having a master's or a PhD in law. They are basically simply saying to us, we think some people got hurt. Not everybody, and I don't feel that there's a threat to trashing the whole system. I think people want land use laws. I think they want some control. But they felt that several people or some people got hurt badly, and they'd like that changed. I'd like to see us discussing a little bit how far that goes. It was my impression in talking to some of the folks over the weekend that they felt this is a kind of a rimshot deal. We're gonna fix it for the people that got it taken back in 73 and forward, but then it's over. And in listening to the testimony, I've heard maybe we have 1,000 applications now, maybe we have less than that, a few more than that. I think there will be more as people understand where we're going, or when it finally becomes clear where we feel it should be going. But, you know, if we had 2,000 or 3,000 applications, when you look at a state of 3,500,000 people, I don't think that's a big deal. It is to the people that got hurt, but it isn't really to the whole population. So I don't think we need to be greatly concerned that we're going to destroy the whole land use system. But I think we need to be very careful to preserve that simplicity that people, I think, and I'm hearing, and I do hear some who are worried, like we've heard today, but most of the opinions that I'm hearing is, let's do it, let's get it over with, let's get it behind us, let's discuss the liabilities of other people looking in, but it really doesn't affect them. You know, we've heard the illustration from Hood River and others that have been mentioned. If they want to run an initiative, let them run an initiative on that look back, too. But that's not this issue. The other issue I heard very loud and clear was, this is really a county problem. It's not a state problem unless you're dealing with permits from forestry or DSL or DEQ or some others that impact Measure 37, but it's the counties that are doing the periodic plans. It's the counties that are doing, and the cities that are doing the zoning, and they are the ones that should be in the driver's seat as far as doing a waiver or raising a fund from which they can pay compensation. And if I remember correctly, it was Speaker of the House O'Neill who said the best government is local government. And I think that's really the way people want us to go, to let people in their community be the ones that are going to be making a final decision. Because it'll be closer to home, it'll be personal, it'll be a lot more fair in terms of the people that are involved in those issues. But I would like to see us discussing a little bit how each of us feel in terms of liability, in terms of transferability, and some of those nitty-gritty issues. We're going to be hearing from some of the agencies, but I think we need to be talking either here or in small groups, discussing it out in the next few days or weeks.
Mr. Chair, can I ask the Vice Chair a question?
Sure.
Representative Anderson, I think what I heard you saying is that you believe the intent of those 500,000 people who voted for it had to do with things that happened in the past, not things that could happen in the future.
That's my impression.
That was my impression as well. That's right.
But that's not the way it is.
Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, thank you, Richard.
I wanted to follow up on that line of reasoning briefly, if I might. Are you switching?
No, go ahead.
Representative Nolan.
Representative Anderson, Representative Greenlick, the way my brain spins that comment out is that you're looking at something that would perhaps set a time limit on when people might make claims in order to clean up past grievances and not create the paralysis of future development plans for communities or livability plans for communities. Am I following your logic correctly, or should I be understanding it differently?
I must say, I read Measure 37, and I was opposed to it because I was afraid that if we went back and let all the people who wanted to do things do it, it would be a big violation for law. But it never, I had it in my head, but never in my gut, that what we're talking about is anything from here on in. Any action, that's a land use action by any city or county, from here on in, if it benefits 96% of the people, and 4% of the people feel that they're not benefited, I mean, 15 years from now, then those 4% of the people will present Measure 37 claims for compensation. And I think that is what it says, but it's not anything that had ever occurred to me. So, I mean, in my heart, not in my head.
Can I follow? Representative Nolan, I read subsection 5 as saying there is kind of a limitation, certainly for the applications, that there's 2 years, and I think that can be extended a little bit, but it kind of implies to me that there is a potential time limit at what time all of these applications will be in, and it doesn't, in my opinion, doesn't transfer to people down the line that they can do the same thing. That may not have been the interpretation of those who wrote it, but that's the way I'm reading it.
Only since for things that
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, as I stated,
I think we started the discussion maybe a month ago that the if we want to really kill Measure 37, just don't do anything. And condemn all these people to at least a decade of litigation. And I don't think that's our purpose. I do believe that, Measure 37 passed. It needs several legislative fixes. I think that the people must have known when they were enacting legislation that was poorly drafted that they were going to cede some of that authority to us. We should exercise it accordingly. And there's lots of easy fixes to make this thing work, but I think that we've gotten off the track on three different ways. The governor's initial statement was this was a compensation measure, and it's really not. It's a land use application measure. The second thing we got off, not necessarily us getting off the track, but Salem getting off the track, is the Senate considering Senator Schrader's bill, which is a revenue bill, which is filed in the Senate, of all places, and having hearings on that extensively. And I don't know what's going to come out of that. It's constitutionally flawed to begin with. The chair is trying to heroically quickly to get the Department of Justice to say something to give us some guidance in terms of the legal issues involved, and they have been playing hide the ball. So perhaps it's up to us at some point to start to isolate the issues that we should be looking at, and they're obviously very, 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 very simple. You need a standardized claim process, or at least a closed process that has some standardized requirements in it, such as a certified appraisal. We have to standardize the court process. It's wide open right now. We might want to consider time limits as to the ultimate time limit beyond which federal claims would not be processed. I was thinking way out 10 years or so. We have to talk about the transferability issue of the waiver. I might want to consider, does a waiver extinguish if it's not used over a long period of time so we can clear these titles? We have to determine, in order to finance these things, as to whether a waiver is some form of a cloud on a title which would preclude financing, or whether we can call it something else, say it's not a cloud on the title, and get the financing package put together, and determine the nature of the interest. So some of these are legal types of concepts. I guess I kind of live in that world, but I don't see anyone really fleshing out any of the, I think, main issues that I believe that Measure 37 needs for standardized, relatively simple process. And I think that's the least we could do for the people that voted for this. So that's my comment.
Representative Summer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My colleague, Representative Nolan, is exactly right. Many, many people in my district did vote in favor of Measure 37. In my district, probably 75% in favor. And I'd like to say I've voted in that majority. And the reason for that vote, of the people, of that many people, obviously they didn't have a claim to file against the state or county or anyone else. But they did acknowledge and they did see, and they wanted to address and rectify what they thought of as an injustice perpetrated on them by Senate Bill 100. There was a very small and limited number of people who are even affected by Measure 37, and I don't know of anyone who denies the existence of those treated unjustly. Coincidentally, this measure did not apply to building permits, zones, building codes or environmental regulation within any city or county. These are not even an issue, and yet I hear it coming up all the time. The transferability of the property, we should look into existing real estate law and see what real estate law says about the transferability and the continuity of ownership of properties. Compensation is not an issue, according to all the people we've heard. I can only remember one municipality who had any sort of plan for compensation. Most of what I heard was the willingness of counties and cities to get on with the process. They didn't see a great deal of impact because of the limited number of people that would be covered by Measure 37. Imagine my shock and surprise when the very next expert opinion would say exactly the opposite of the one previous. We were told a lot of things that were frankly not accurate. They were not accurate. We were told about suits being filed neighbor to neighbor and the like. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there are already processes in every municipality that covers those eventualities. There are public hearings. Their right to object to any permit before any city or county issues those permits. That's a non-issue. I think what we have and what we need to address here is how many people, how many individual property owners are we going to sit by and watch being treated unfairly and unjustly before we finally implement a workable plan to get this thing done. In my view, that number should be zero. None of us should sit by and watch any person in Oregon being treated unjustly. And unjustly means deprived of the right to use their property. Just an opinion.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. One of the suggestions I heard down in Josephine County was, why don't we bring in all the different counties' proposals, especially the counties, and you have a task force where they represent people that could represent, say, a region, or maybe bring as many of the counties want to come, and try and get a standardization of the various proposals that each one of them are putting in. We heard from Common Sense to, I think Jackson County has a plan, they're already accepting waivers, or giving waivers. So might be good in preparation from hearing from DOJ and the AG's office and getting some definitions, what the different counties are doing, and try and pull them together in a way that's a little bit more logical.
Mr. Schleck is out in the audience. Art, would you be open to that, of sampling the county's applications, giving this committee a copy of those applications so we could kind of see where there's continuity and where there isn't?
Mr. Chair, we can share the ones that we have with you. If you would do that, I think the committee would
very greatly appreciate that. Any other comments? Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, I just had a question for you. Has there been any feedback yet from Multnomah County if we're going to have them come present their what they're doing on Measure 37 claims?
We are currently having some discussions with Multnomah County in regards to a certain bill that has passed through the Senate, and when we hopefully shortly will have a formal public announcement to make about that bill. So,
I guess my question, follow-up, please, was, are they going to come present to us what their process claim on their deposits? I've now been told they're doing a bond. I don't know if that's accurate or not. Requirements for Measure 37 claim.
Sam, if you can perhaps contact Multnomah County and ask.
Thank you.
Would you like the planning department?
I would like the planning department.
The planning department to
explain what their process is.
We'll do that, Representative Brown.
Mr. Chair, isn't the Association of Oregon Counties going to compile all that stuff for hopefully 36 counties?
Of those that are there, as Mr. Schleck indicated, of the counties that have made their application process available to them. So we'll check that and see if Multnomah County is in there.
Okay, great, thanks.
When the speaker assigned this committee and gave me the chair, I can only tell you how absolutely pleased I was to have such capable people on this committee. In the weeks and months ahead, we do face a difficult task, but well, we got some great people here, and I appreciate you just being able to sit here and discuss this, and we'll continue to move forward in the process on Wednesday. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I'm a little bit unclear of what our mission is now. We're going to review applications of counties and cities. I got lost on that last little work assignment, and let me just go a bit further, because I have enough information in my head about the variations of the applications from the previous testimony, and I don't see what we're going to gather by churning back through this stuff again. I would prefer a situation perhaps where some of the experts out in the audience could give us a list of things that they felt should be standardized by statewide legislation, those which they feel should be left to local control. They use that reservoir of knowledge to sort of get us moving. I'm just making that suggestion because that's where I'm ready to go. I'm kind of not ready to sit down and look at all these applications again.
Any other comments? Representative Nolan.
At the risk of micromanaging, because we're not in the executive branch, we're in the legislative branch, I didn't understand that discussion we just had about the counties to be a review of individual applications so much as a review or analysis of the processes, the implementing ordinances that the counties have put in place. And in my analytical type brain, I have in mind that perhaps LCDC since I see they've left the room and so they're primed to get an assignment from us, might identify the key issues that they've they think are important in local implementing ordinances relating to filing fees and whether an appraisal is required and issues around demonstration of continuity of ownership and all the other things we've heard about, and then basically have 36 columns that say this is how Baker County's doing it, this is how Lake County's doing it, this is how Multnomah County's doing it, this is how Washington County is doing each one of those things. And hopefully there would come about some semblance of a consensus, if there is one, or absent one, this committee might say, you know, on this issue, we think this is the way that it ought to be handled so that a developer or a property owner knows whether they live in Washington County or Malheur County, that that's what they can expect. Or at least the committee, excuse me, Mr. Chair, could say, this is a decision that the legislature ought to make because it has statewide significance. This one is an issue that ought to be local, and it's okay if it's different between Douglas and Clackamas County. But we ought to make that distinction.
Well, I think that's another message that's been delivered very clearly to us, is that we must give the counties and local government flexibility to handle the actual land use decision within their own body, with only sideboards from us. Perhaps we could take Representative Ackerman's database as a base to begin the evaluations of the county information and kind of use that to go forward.
I'm getting, you know, concerned as I know where the counties are coming from. I also know that no one's doing anything on some of the issues I mentioned about the transferability, the standardization of the court processes, the standardization of the claims process is pretty easy, I think, but we can glean that. But the financing issues, the cloud of the title types of issues, I know these are more legal types of problems that they're not addressing. So I'm just on a little different dimension here. I'm thinking maybe more law than process. I don't know.
Well, maybe it would be wise to use your database to establish questions and just put it out to the counties and any interested persons.
So we could do that.
Let us have your input in regards to these areas that we feel the legislature has to take a serious look at.
Yeah, and I might say I have some bills in legislative council right now will be popping out almost any day that will address some of the issues that I mentioned. We could use that as a working format. I'll play that out. There are about 15 bills coming out.
I think that could expedite the process, and I understand what you're saying, that we don't want to get bogged down. So,
Chair, I just wanted to add that we have a deadline on February 28th. We're going to have many bills, I'm sure, that address maybe Measure 37 claims, and that would be a good springboard for us to work from.
Yep. Any other comments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenwood.
We have a little luxury here of a little time to work on this, which we are working, and being I guess maybe I've been a professor for too many years, but I sometimes go back to the underlying theoretical basis of what our democracy is built on. And in this case, the basic elements of our democracy is a representative democracy, because sometimes our representatives, using good and firm democratic processes, make decisions that in fact benefit one class of citizens and do not benefit, or negatively benefit, if you will, other classes of citizens. And I don't think we've ever found a way in democracy to say we'll go with a rule of the majority and then we'll make sure any decision holds, make sure that anybody in the minority gets anything they want out of the process as well. And I think about the land use in my district, which is probably the second, the housing stock in my district is probably the second highest value of any district. At least it was in the 1990 census, and I think it's probably still at reading the 2000 census data. And a great deal of that value in that housing stock has come about because of the land use laws we've had in place the last 30 years. And while there are individuals who may have not been able to do what they wanted, I have a sense that the value of the stock and probably what helps with the real estate industry getting very nice commissions off selling houses in my district because they sell for so much has to do with the system. Now, when if that system breaks, the system that allowed my community to grow the way it grew and your community to grow the way it grew, I sense a degradation, the potential of a gradual degradation of property values for the majority. And somehow in this process, as we work through Measure 37, honoring the will of the voters, because you've heard me say over and over in many things, I think the voters need to have more say. We also need to make sure that the long-term common good is also honored in this model. And somehow I think we just need to remind ourselves that the kind of system we've developed over the last 25 years, last 30 years, has had, as I said before and said in Sandy, has had some stupid decisions, and we ought to do something to deal with those stupid decisions. We ought to make sure people are protected from dumb land use decisions. But on the other hand, the notion, and I read Measure 37 in the second half of Section 5 of it, as I said, Representative Anderson, as applying to any land use decision of any kind in the future. And I don't think there's anybody in the, certainly not 600,000 voters, who would like to say we don't want to deal somehow with the common good while we also try and find a way to protect a minority from irrational kind of decisions that come forward. And I just hope we keep in mind that we can't necessarily all rush to the other side of the boat on this one, because a lot of people will be hurt in a lot of very important ways if we don't keep what's good in the land use system and give counties and cities the kind of authority they need to plan the kind of counties and cities and neighborhoods that they want. I don't think we want to handcuff them from having the ability to do what they need to do for the future well-being of their citizens. And it's just something that I don't know how that codifies into should you do A versus B in these decisions, but I think it's something we ought to try and keep in the background at all times. I mean, this is not, there is a lot of common good that we have to protect in the way our cities and counties plan for the future. And we somehow want to keep that in place while we're protecting against stupid decisions along the way. I don't know where that gets us, but
I think you just said what all of us feel to a certain degree. Perhaps we wouldn't be as eloquent as stating it as you've just been. But thank you, Representative. Representative Anderson.
Under pressure. Hi, boys.
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard it said, I haven't been able to prove it out yet, but I've heard it said that the nation of France has almost non-existent land use laws, and yet Paris is one of the more beautiful cities of the world and the Chateau country and all that. It doesn't seem that they have had a major problem because they have not had real strict land use laws. And I think we've run well out in front of the rest of the nation. Many of the other states have land use laws that are nowhere near as restrictive as ours. And I hear people saying, I don't want to see the laws taken away, but I do want to see them made more reasonable, and in so doing, be able to attract the people we'd like to see here, the employers that bring jobs. And that's where I see it. It's just kind of bringing us back more into balance with the democracy all across the nation.
Sounds like we need to focus on more of Representative Greenwich's stupid laws. Anyone else wish to comment? I appreciate the committee, and I appreciate our open discussion today. And we will adjourn our work session on Measure 37 and adjourn the committee on land use.